You're listening to another episode of the Something Beautiful podcast. This week on the episode, we have Annie Dorsey. Annie shares her story about getting caught up in drugs and going to prison ultimately for that. And also, she touches on somewhat of the redemption story in that. And so we're going to talk with her. This will be part one of her story with Annie Dorsey. That'll be coming up right here on the Something Beautiful podcast.
This broadcast is brought to you by Christian House. Christian House is your online source for Bibles, books, and music. Check out our website at www.christianhouse.com.
You're listening to Something Beautiful, part of the Emergent Podcast Network. For more information about this and other great shows, visit us online at www.emergentpodcast.com.
All right, everyone, you're listening to the Something Beautiful podcast, episode 22, and still celebrating our one-year birthday anniversary. And Stuart's on the other line with me all the way over in Scotland. I'm here in Red Oak in our Texas studios. So y'all have to share the Scotland studios, I guess, and I get the whole Texas studio to myself.
Yeah. Well, Texas is bigger than Scotland, so...
So I got a lot of room to spread out.
Absolutely. Not that you need it, obviously.
Yeah, I don't need any room to spread out. I need to tighten that belt up.
Yep. So how are you?
I'm doing well. Just working today, and we're getting ready to launch our new catalog for the school district, for the college district, and so I get to go through and check every single link in our catalog, and I think we have 300 something degree plans, and who knows how many courses linked on each of those pages. And it's just, I'm trying to describe the boredom, but I don't know if I can.
Oh, it's coming over.
Good.
I feel your pain.
How about you? What are you up to?
Today, I've had a pretty a kind of odd week. I've been watching the Church of Scotland's General Assembly on the web. They webcast their General Assembly, so I've been watching that and blogging a bit about it. And I managed to get a link to my blog on the Times newspaper, which is kind of like, I guess, one of the top newspapers in the UK. So my blog hits went through the roof on Sunday.
Now, was that actually in the print version or the online version?
No, it's just on the online version in one of the columns, but it's still, you know, my hits jumped to nearly 600 in a day. So, yeah, it's pretty good. So, yeah, I've been doing that, and this morning I spoke to Lawrence Moore for Something Beautiful, so we'll hear that in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
So, yeah, I've been doing that and working away.
And you've had quite a number of blogs about the church conference, so we'll have a link on the podcast so people can check that out and find out more about that, what's going on.
Yeah, it's been a controversial week.
Well, what's been the biggest controversy?
Well, the biggest controversy was that an openly gay minister wanted to move church, and someone brought a complaint about the presbytery, which is kind of like the area committee, hadn't handled it properly. And so there was a whole lot of discussion about that, and mostly they fudged the issue. So they haven't really resolved anything at all. They've allowed Scott to be inducted to his new church, but they haven't decided whether or not anyone else can. In fact, they've banned anyone else, any other gay ministers, from moving for 2 years while they talk about it. So it's an interesting...
Yeah, it reminds me kind of Proposition 8 over here from what I hear. It's, you know, we're going to... You can't be homosexual and be married in California, but if you were before all of this went down, you're still legal, but no one else can be legal, you know.
Okay. So it's almost exactly the same.
Yeah.
We don't know what to do with this, so we'll let you get inducted, and then we'll just reset to before.
Right.
Where we were. So that's kind of what's happened. So, and a lot of other stuff about, there's a lot of complaints about people talking in the press before the case was heard and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, lots of good stuff to blog about anyway from the outside. And Desmond Tutu spoke to the assembly today, so that was pretty cool. So that's online, so we could put a link to that. He was very, very good.
Cool.
As you would expect.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. Well, let's get to the story with Annie without any further delay, and let people hear what she has to say.
Could there be more rain? Could there be more night? Could there be understanding that could set things right? Yes, the thunder calls me. Yeah, I find you there. I reach out for your cold hand.
All right, today on our podcast, the Something Beautiful podcast, have a good friend, Annie Dorsey. Annie and her family grew up in the same church that I grew up in, and so we've known each other for a long time. She grew up a close friend with my sister, and I was over at their house a lot, she was over at our house a lot, seeing each other at church and so forth. And Annie has a great story that I'm really looking forward to sharing with our listeners today. And so, Annie, thank you for joining us today on the show.
Absolutely.
Now tell us just briefly about maybe who you are, kind of what you do currently.
Well, I work for an insurance brokerage right now. I've been there since November, and I work in the office services side of the insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom owns a gym, so I work there, and I cater and hang out with friends, and that's about it.
All right, sounds good. And we're calling you, you're in Forney, Texas now, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, tell us just a little bit. I know that I know probably a lot of growing up, just watching you grow up and so forth. I guess you're about 5 years younger than me. But what do you remember about growing up, elementary school, junior high school? Was there anything that stood out to you? Do you remember certain things about your childhood?
Well, I'm in the middle of five kids.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up with many siblings. I love my siblings. I love, I just love family, a big family. I could never imagine being the only child. I just love it.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in church. My mom has always taken us to church. I was raised in a really great home. I couldn't ask for a better family now. We're still very close. And, that's just the way I was raised. My mom is kind of, people would consider my mom a strict mom, but, she's just kind of old school, really. And
mm-hmm.
she just has morals and standards that she expected us to live up to, and that's the way I was raised completely.
And now I guess you could probably say she had a pretty standard upbringing. Nothing real out of the ordinary. Grew up in suburban Dallas. Nothing
yeah.
or anything.
Yeah, I grew up in Mesquite, and in my freshman year, we moved out to Forney.
Okay. Freshman year of high school, moved to Forney?
Yes.
Okay.
And then, I went to Forney for 2 years, and then I went to Metropolitan Christian School for 2 years and graduated from there.
Okay. Now, what is your view of God while you're growing up, coming up through high school and so forth? You mentioned that your mom kind of had these standards that she wanted y'all to live up to, but was that something that you felt on your own, or was it just something that you did to kind of please mom and dad?
Well, growing up, definitely to please my mom. I did, when you're a kid, you just kind of do what your parents want, and I think a lot of it was that, and, she wanted us to go to church, she took us to church, and so that's where we went every Sunday. But
mm-hmm.
eventually, I realized that that's where I need to be, and, now, God, I couldn't imagine not having God in my life. So, I can't imagine how people cannot believe in God for any experiences. But definitely, I definitely have a way different view now than, I did when I was, 12, 13. I just went because that's what my mom made me do, or go to church camp, or, just all the stuff that you do when you're young and you grow up in church. But, I think as you go through life and you go through experiences, then you realize that there's no way you could have come through that without God. And so, yeah, that's about where I'm at in life.
Okay. Now, I guess you spent a year in, or you spent 2 years at Forney High School, at public high school. Then you transferred to the Christian school. What kind of impact did that have on your life, transferring? You've been in public school your whole life and then transferring into this Christian environment.
Well, I loved it because the friends that I had grew up with in church went there. And at Forney was real small then. And all they did was party out here, and my mom wanted to get away from that. And she gave us the choice of staying in Forney or going to Metropolitan, and both me and my older brother decided to go to Metropolitan, and we loved it. I'm absolutely glad that I went there instead of graduating from Forney. And it was just a smaller, more compact place where you could get to know more people and you learned better. And they had Bible classes, and I can't really say that I paid a lot of attention in Bible class there. And honestly, probably my junior and senior year, I still didn't care about whether I had a good relationship with God or not. But I definitely, my mom gave us the choice to go there, and we chose to go there.
Okay.
And so, private schools are a lot different, but they're a bigger impact on your life, I think.
So you would say overall it was a positive experience, that you definitely got a lot out of it?
Oh, yeah.
Good. Now, what's going on, and I'm not sure on the timeline here, but I know somewhere kind of around this point, if I recall, your parents went through a divorce. Is that correct?
Yeah. In 1999, we moved to Forney, and in 2001, I started going to Metropolitan. In 2003, I graduated, and it was like between my junior and senior year that my dad left.
Okay.
And my family was still real close. We didn't, we still talked to my dad. He lived 5 minutes away. And they're still split up, but they still talk all the time. So, but yeah, I'm not really sure. It was either 2002 or 2003.
Okay, so while you're in high school, your junior senior year is kind of when that's going on. Is that playing out any as far as affecting you emotionally or anything?
I don't really. Thanks. I wouldn't say so, because my dad has always been a hard worker, and he's always provided for our family, but he's never really been there for us. I mean, I just think he shows his love and emotion differently, and I think that, I'm more of a I love you emotional person. I think he's more of a giving, and he thinks that by providing is showing his love. And so I've never really been real, real close to him just due to that, because he is a hard worker and he was gone a lot.
Well, and I think that's a good point. I think that a lot of people would cast stones quickly and say, well, my dad wasn't here for me or whatever, but I think that's a good point that you bring up, that his way of showing love was probably a little bit different than what you might have preferred, or, you know, kind of your love language. So it might have been hard to distinguish that at points, but I think it's good that you realize that there may have been, you know, he may have just been expressing his love differently than you may.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So what happens then when you graduate high school, graduate from the private school there? Were you making plans to go to college, go into a workforce?
I wanted to be a nurse. I had wanted to be, I mean, since I was in first grade, I wrote stories about it. I always just wanted to be a nurse. Mm-hmm. And I looked into it. At the time, I played basketball. I played basketball for 13 years, my senior year. A few schools I was looking at and looking at going and playing basketball for them and getting scholarships. But I just decided to stay home and to go to a community college in Terrell, TVCC. Mm-hmm. And I went there for a semester, and I got A's and B's. I was doing great. Mm-hmm. And then I got out of school, or I finished that semester, and then things just kind of went downhill from there. I mean, my one of my real good friends at the time, her parents kicked her out, and she came to my house. I had a job. She came to my house and asked me if I wanted to move out with her. Mm-hmm. And so I think a big part of me moved out because I felt like my whole life my mom confined me in this little bubble. Mm-hmm. And it was just time to get away from it, you know. And I think when you turn 18, you're just like, oh, I can leave now, you know. And so I think I've always kind of been a little rebellious. And so at that point, I was just like, well, I can do what I want. I'm 18. Mm-hmm. So I moved out with her. There wasn't really any place to go, and she knew some guys that lived in Plano, and they said that we could move in with them as long as we got jobs. So I moved out that night. I called my mom. She had no clue. Mm-hmm. And I just told her that I wasn't coming home and that I was moving out. And that night, we went to the guy's apartment, and they had cocaine and meth and weed, and I don't even know what else in the house. Mm-hmm. And instead of turning around and saying, oh my gosh, I've never been around this in my life, I just kind of thought it was fun because I hadn't been around it. And mm-hmm. because it was a different world that my mom really tried to keep us from going. And so, and just to keep us safe. And so, the first night I didn't do anything, and everybody there kept saying, do y'all want to do some cocaine? Do y'all want to do some meth? Blah, blah, blah. And I just kept saying no, no. I played sports all through school, and so all through high school I was drug tested. So I mm-hmm. never was interested in doing drugs because I love sports. Mm-hmm. And so now that I'm out of school, now that I'm 18 and I think I can do whatever I want, the second night I decided I'm going to do it. Mm. Well, my first drug ever was cocaine, and
you don't take it. You don't take it easy starting off.
I don't really know how. You know, I think at that time I just wanted to be so independent that I wanted to do whatever and not have to answer to anybody. And so I just thought, well, if I want to do this, then I can do it. Mm-hmm. So, I did cocaine, and then the next, I kept doing it all night, and the next morning I'm still awake, and I got in the shower, and I weighed on the scale, and I lost 10 pounds in one night.
Wow.
I had worked out all my life and never lost that kind of weight. Mm-hmm. When I graduated high school, I weighed 160, and that's just kind of the start of it. I mean, once I realized how much weight I lost, I was just like, oh my gosh, I want to do more. So I continued doing it, and then I ended up mixing cocaine and meth, and meth is very, very, very addicting. Cocaine is too, but meth is what I ended up getting addicted on.
Okay.
I moved out January 19th. By the end of March, I weighed 103.
Wow.
And I still thought I was fat. You know, drugs mess up your mind so bad that you still don't see yourself like other people see you.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got kicked out of that apartment because we did drugs. And I ended up moving in with a friend's dad that cooked dope at his house, meth at his house.
Okay.
And a bunch of people came over there all the time and cooked meth in his house. And so I just kind of watched them. And my brain is so messed up then. I mean, I know this sounds crazy, but my brain is so messed up then that I didn't even realize how crazy of a lifestyle I was even living and that I was even addicted by this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I avoided my family altogether. They would call. They would try to find me. If I knew they were looking for me, I'd go to a different house, and I've just moved and moved and moved and moved and moved.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at that house, I met a guy that cooked meth that I decided I moved in with. So I moved in with him. I was 19. He was 36. I moved in with him, and he taught me how to cook meth. And so I started doing that with him and staying up all night and cooking meth and started selling it. And, I just thought that was normal. I mean, it was good money. I mean, I was still skinny. I could wear whatever I wanted. Still had no family in my life. You know, I was so caught up in this little bitty world that everyone else is doing drugs that I just couldn't get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was driving down the road and he got arrested, or he got pulled over for a headlight, and they found meth in his car, so he got arrested. So I had to move out of his house. I moved back to Mesquite. And in Mesquite, I met another guy, moved in with him. And for the last year that I did meth, I moved in with him. We got an apartment together. He was actually on probation already, so I put the apartment in my name.
Okay.
So that he couldn't get caught. And I taught him to cook meth. So then we're both addicted to meth. And at this time, a few months into our relationship, we started hitting each other. I wouldn't say that it was all his fault. I mean, he definitely hit me harder than I could ever hit him, but I also hit him.
Okay.
And our relationship just got worse and worse and worse, and more and more and more into drugs. I've tried ecstasy, I've tried acid, all through all that. I've just, anything that was put in front of me, I just tried it. And drugs mess up your mind so bad that you like want to rush out of something else because you're so addicted to the drugs that it really doesn't give you a rush anymore. And so I started stealing. I would steal from department stores, and just my whole life was just totally messed up from what, way different from the way I grew up. And so right before our relationship ended, during our relationship, he had tried to shoot me twice.
Wow.
One time,
just kind of out of rage or accidentally?
Oh, no. definitely on purpose. He thought I was cheating on him, which I wasn't. I never left the house because I was doing too many drugs and too concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
And two, I had called him a bad name in front of a bunch of people, and he got mad that they thought it was funny that I said that. So, and it's just decisions that you're on drugs that you don't even think that it's any problem. I mean, he just thought it wasn't a big deal. And so I finally started to realize that this relationship isn't going to work and I'm going to end up dying. In July of 03, we were in our living room in the apartment, and
July of 05,
he hit me over the head with a tequila bottle because he was mad and way messed up and drunk and on anything he could find. And I went to the hospital all night. Actually, I laid on my couch and bled all night until I realized that it wasn't going to stop and that I had to go to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took me to the hospital, and I lied and said a police officer came in there, and he asked if my boyfriend had hit me. And I lied. I said no. I had gotten a fight at a bar, and that somebody had hit me over the head with a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And they stitched me up. I went home. A few days later, I saw my mom. I told my mom that I ran into a fence running with my dog. just everything was just a big lie.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really couldn't keep my story straight. And whatever I thought of at that time, that's what I said. So I think now that I look back at that, I think maybe that was God telling me to wake up and realize that you are going to die here. But of course he came back, and I think all guys that end up hitting women always feel sorry and always apologize. And then the next time it happens, they apologize again. And of course that's what happened. And I just felt like I was so in love with him that it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so he promised he'd never hit me again. It went for about a month, and then he started hitting me again. And that would have been August of...
Okay, of 05.
The beginning of August, yeah. And then we kept selling drugs out of our house. People would come over at all times of the night. They would bring stolen stuff over to our house. It was just an all-day, all-night thing. It never stopped. And so August 13th of 05, we got in a real bad fight, and he threw a full Dr. Pepper can at my head, and I ducked, and it went through the window and busted the window.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ran outside and started running. We lived on the third story of some apartments, and I ran outside and started running down the stairs. Well, by the time he got to the top of the stairs, I was already at the bottom, so I'm kind of laughing that he can't catch me. And we had a front and a back door that both had stairs to the third story, so I just kept running around and up and down and around, and he couldn't catch me. So I'm not sure how long that went on. It felt like it went on a long time, but I can't really tell you because I was so messed up and so high on anything that I could find that I couldn't honestly say. So eventually I got inside and realized that I could just lock the back door and he couldn't get in. So I locked the back door and I went in the bedroom, and the next thing I know, I was passed out. I had been up for like 7 days at that. Meth makes you stay up a long time, and if you take it right before you're fixing to fall asleep, then it'll make you stay up for hours, and you do it again and again and again and again, and you just keep staying up, and you don't eat. I mean, I probably ate once every 5 days for a year.
Wow.
And so at this point, all this running, I'm just exhausted. And so, and he had the meth in his pocket, and he sure wasn't going to give me any by this point. So I passed out on the bed, and I woke up to at least 20 police officers in my room, and they pulled me off the bed. I hit the floor and woke up. And they had kicked in my door, but I was so passed out that I didn't hear it. That many cops had come into my apartment, and I didn't hear it. And I was the only one there. So they came in, and they kept asking me if I do drugs. There's drugs everywhere. And I kept telling them, no, no, no. I don't know who that is, you know. And there was guy stuff everywhere. They asked me if a guy lived there, and I said no, because I really thought that, you know, it wasn't going to be a deal. They were just going to leave, I guess.
Right.
So I ended up getting arrested that day. And I went to jail, and it took me about a month in jail before I could eat. And I slept the whole time. You have to get up in jail to get counted, but and to get a meal, but every time I'd just give it away because I was so exhausted. My body was just so, it had been 2 years of doing that. And so I sat in jail for at least 3 or 4 months and kept thinking that my boyfriend was going to get me out. And I kept talking to him, and he kept telling me he was going to get me out. And at this time, my mom was coming to see me every week. My sister was coming to see me my sister and her husband were coming to me every week. They wrote me every single day. When I got out of jail, I had over 400 letters.
Wow. That's from your family?
Oh, yeah. And my mom's church, who all, I didn't even know the people. And they had prayed for me for so long, and that I really got to know them in jail. And then when I got out of jail, I got to meet them.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a good 3-4 months for me to realize that my life was so messed up and I wanted to change. And I started going to church in jail, and a lot of people do that. A whole lot of people do that. And I think they really hope for a change, but then they get back out, and it's so hard that they just go back to the way that they were living.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up being in jail for 7 months, and my mom started looking into a Christian rehab program that was in Houston, and it was a 13-month in-house rehab. And I went to court, and they charged me with 3 felonies. I had meth, some pills, and a drug called GHB when I got caught. And so those are all first-degree felonies, which carry a minimum of 5 to 99 years.
Wow.
So you basically have to go in front of the judge and say if you think you're guilty or not, and say what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I went to court, they offered me 20 years of prison. And my mom, I had a court-appointed attorney because my mom just thought that because I got myself into it, that I, you know, I could deal with the consequences that came with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I can't say that I could do that with my kid because it was really hard. Every time she came and saw me, she cried. Every holiday, she cried. And it was so hard. I was there for my birthday. I was there for Christmas, for Thanksgiving. And every day, she came and saw me. And so she always cried and told me that she so wished that she could get me out, but she knows that I'm better off in there, and that she knows I can't do drugs in there. So I finally got out, and I pleaded guilty. I knew that my life was messed up, and I didn't care by that point what they gave me, because I knew that I needed to be kept straight somehow, and I didn't want to just get out and be able to do whatever I want, because the likelihood of me going back to that is very, very high. So I took 13 months in-house rehab and 5 years probation.
Okay.
And I went to rehab. The judge gave me a week to go home and pack and to go to rehab. And my mom drove me to rehab. All the people that I said that had wrote me from my mom's church, before I went to rehab, they threw me a party for being sober.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody at that church had done drugs. Nobody had kids that did drugs. And so through my mom and through watching what all I had been through and what all I was still going through and just hearing from my mom every week about how I was doing, they started to understand how somebody could get so wrapped up in it and not even – I didn't grow up that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so they threw me a party. I met all of them. They gave me, like, these little cards that had their prayers for me that they had prayed for years while I was doing drugs, and then verses at the bottom in their name on different cards. And they said that when I go to rehab, that when I – start getting depressed there or start feeling like my life is nothing, that to read those.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to rehab, and I stayed there for 2 months, and I just decided I didn't want to be there anymore, and the court made me go there even though it was my choice. And I wanted to get out, so I ran away from it.
Was Blue Ocean Blue from Lake, not Lakey or Lucky or whatever it was you told me. I just did the M thing again. I'm gonna stop doing that. So, tell us about that fantastic conversation with Annie. How you've known Annie?
At least most of her life. I guess she's about 5 years younger than me. She grew up as a close friend of my youngest sister, Kara, and they kind of grew up in church together, and I'm still good friends with her family, especially her oldest sister, Dolly, who she mentions, and I'm not sure if it was this part or the next part, but just a really great family. Like she said, she's the middle of 5 siblings, and so always lots of activity going on at their house growing up. And it's been fun watching her grow up, especially knowing her story. And seeing how God's kind of worked through her, and people praying for her, and just glad to see that she's come out on the other side.
Yeah, I think, I guess for me, not knowing her, what fascinated me about this half of the story was, such a normal, I guess, childhood and upbringing. Really into sport, a kind of fit, healthy young woman who's involved in church and doing all that kind of stuff, and how easily sometimes it is just to kind of fall away from that so very quickly, it takes us one saying yes, I guess, and there you go.
Yeah, and I thought it was real interesting talking to her. I think maybe knowing her as I do, and knowing some of the story that as I do, it was, I thought it was really admirable and really great that she never pointed fingers. And I don't think that she has anyone to point fingers at necessarily, but you know, a lot of people will come on and say, well, this happened in my childhood. You know, my parents got divorced at this age. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, she even mentioned her mom was somewhat strict, you know, just growing up. But she doesn't point blame at her mom and say, well, it's my mom's fault. She took full responsibility for it. And I think that that's, I mean, that's above admirable. I think that that's just great that she says, hey, I just needed some space. I decided to take advantage of it. And this is what it led me to.
Yeah. And, you know, it's it's quite a journey, isn't it? It's difficult. I think, when you hear a story like that, it's difficult to comprehend what that must be like. And so to hear someone talk about it so openly is a real privilege to get an insight like that into someone's life and the kind of things that go around that kind of drug use and the way that I guess she talked about normalizing that that's what happened she talked a little bit about I think she was living with someone who was cooking meth and that was normal and you kind of wonder how in someone's head you go from going to school and playing basketball and and how does living in a house where you're cooking meth,
right,
become normal? And I guess that's what drugs do. They skew your understanding of yourself and what's going on. She talked about that in terms of our weight loss and those kinds of things that that just becomes who you are and what you do, and it takes over so much of your life. I guess that. It's really difficult for other people to comprehend how much a drug habit really does take over your life.
Yeah, and I think that, and she pointed out this a little bit before we even started our conversation, but that so often, and we've talked about this on so many other topics on our show, so often we point fingers at someone and label them, well, they're a drug user. Or, oh, they're caught up in sex trade. Or, whatever finger we want to point, whatever label we want to point, but we don't understand what's going through that person's mind at that time. It may be a simple mistake of, hey, I'm going to try Coke once. And before long, we're caught up and we don't even know what normal is anymore. And so I think that that's, like every other person on our podcast, I think that you have to stop and listen to someone's story. Take the time to understand that guy or that girl and, rather than putting that label on them, just another story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think one of the things I've obviously been involved in youth work, I've, kind of come across a lot of kids that have been into drugs at various points. And for all of them, when you ask them, well, why did you do it? And, the reality is that, the first time that you do drugs, it feels great. There's like a kind of denial around that initial stage that, people take drugs because it makes them feel better. And then the kind of the decline comes, later on, and because of addiction and stuff. It's easy, I think, when you hear people talking about, that kind of, it felt pretty good at the start, and it's not until you get into, your habit develops that it doesn't feel so good, and it becomes a bit maintenance. And I think sometimes there's a kind of denial around about that, drugs are bad, kind of thing. And it's hard to say that to a lot of kids who are maybe using drugs, on the weekend or whatever. Who are saying, well, actually, I quite like it. And to hear a story like Annie's, I think. It shows where that can go, taking drugs on the weekend can lead to so much destruction in your life and so much heartache and hurt, and ultimately, for Annie, that that ends up in a pretty bad place. So I think, you know, you're right, we have to listen to people's stories and we have to understand what drives people to take drugs in the first place. And I'm not sure that we're very good at that, particularly in the church, because we don't tend to put ourselves in places where we might hear that story. You know, unless we meet someone like Annie who's come through the other side of it, and you know, it's in some ways it's a testimony. You know, we tend, as you said, we ignore people when they're in the middle of that. You know, we like to hear the story of, you know, how someone's been redeemed, but you know, it's difficult for us to hear that story and difficult to know what to do.
Right. Well, and I think you touched on a good point that, you know, she wanted to feel good, or she wanted, and most people that do drugs, it's that initial, I wanted to feel better. And I guess I was lucky, I was never around, I knew people that did drugs, but growing up I was never around it that much. You know, I tried weed once, and for me it did nothing. I mean, I guess, I don't know, but, you know, my friend was like, sometimes the first time you try weed, it doesn't really do much. And for me, I guess I got lucky because I tried it and it did nothing and I moved on. I was like, well, no point. But, you know, I also spent time probably drinking more than I should growing up, you know, especially in college. Yeah. And it was because you do feel better, you know. And there's a great scene in The West Wing where someone asks Leo McGarry, the chief of staff, you know, I don't understand why you would drink like that. I don't understand why you'd be addicted to this. And he's like, it's such a great feeling. I don't know why anyone wouldn't. He's like, you feel so good. Why would you not want to feel like this all the time? And I think that's part of the drug that your body, you do get, you know, your body has changed, your mental state has changed, and so it does feel good. But I guess ultimately there's a root issue to all of that, all those addictions, that we're not finding happiness somewhere in our life, and so we're seeking it through the drugs, through the alcohol, through whatever. And the church doesn't do a good thing of recognizing when people may need that happiness before they get to the drugs.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that we talk about, you know, we keep coming back to is this sense of, you know, that Christ came to give us life, and its fullness, and that means ups and downs, but it means that, you know, the following God's about being joyful, you know, and you know, I think too often the church has been very guilty of sucking the joy from life. You know, we get very serious, and you know, there was we talked earlier on about the General Assembly. There was a discussion about it's a report on being single, and a guy stood up and was very frank and very honest and very funny about the fact that he had sex with his wife before he was married. People were appalled, not so much by the fact he admitted that he'd had sex before he was married, but because he was funny. Do you know, and they thought he was being flippant. And he wasn't being flippant. He was making a really serious point, but he did it with humour. And you can think, oh, for goodness sake, you know, stop taking yourself so seriously. You know, and just listen to what the guy's got to say. And, you know, I think, you know, growing up around that kind of environment, sometimes you have to wonder, you know, it's not a big surprise that that people go off and look for other ways to make themselves happy. You know, and you know, that's a pretty challenging.
And that happiness will manifest itself in so many ways. I mean, everybody's going to find their own.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, this morning we were talking about finding happiness through buying iPods, or buying a bigger house, or buying a bigger car. You know, you get caught up in the materialism. Or maybe you're finding your happiness through sexual desires. Maybe you're finding your happiness through food. Maybe you're finding your happiness through TV, movies. I mean, it's going to manifest itself in some way. And it's finding a balance of denying oneself and following Christ. And when you just hear that, you think, well, geez, I can't be happy at all. But no, it's not that. It's just it's finding a balance where you're not seeking happiness through other means. You know, you're content. You're happy, as Paul says. I'm content in all things.
Yeah. I think that's I'm dumbstruck by your list of I think you're right. You know, I think, you know, and I think what we tend to do is we point at certain ways that people seek out to try and fill that space. So we say that people who drink too much or have sex, in some way they're mm-hmm. much worse than, you know, people who, you know, seek that happiness in other ways that are maybe a little bit more socially acceptable, I guess, that, you know, so, you know, buying lots of stuff doesn't hurt right. anyone. And that's the justification that we make for that, but, you know, it's not any better in some ways, you know, it still is I guess, an indication of the same mm-hmm. kind of problem. And
I saw on Twitter, and I wish I remembered who said this, but someone said, Christians hate people who sin differently than them.
Yeah, it was that, was it Kim Meyer? I think I retweeted someone else, and that really struck me, and that tweet came through from somebody in the States while I was watching the General Assembly, and I just thought, you know, how mm-hmm. how true that is, you know, that really struck me during that debate, but it mm-hmm. works in all kinds of ways. We're so pompous sometimes.
As long as you sin like me, I can live with you,
yeah.
but if you're sinning differently, yeah. get out of my sight.
Yeah, because I don't understand your kind of sin. I get my kind of sin, but I don't, you know, you can take your sin somewhere else.
After all the windows on the ground floor had been broken, after all the undemanding officers had spoken, after all the trouble, after all of the commotion, I walked right through the door. It's always open. When I was 17, I set out on the ocean, searching for Columbus, or wherever he was going. In 20,000 miles, came down to just a moment, I sailed right through the door. It's always open.
Hi there, it's Thomas here, and it's my turn to do the 10-minute sort of birthday introduction thingy. So I just want to say I am so proud and so happy to consider this little podcast has reached its first year in existence. I'm delighted, giddy in fact, at the thought. When I look back over the year, all those episodes with all those cool people, I'm just blissed out. God is good. Up front, I have a confession to make. I never thought my involvement would last. I am great with ideas and kicking things off, but then my interest wanes, I get bored and I move on to something else. This hasn't happened. I am more excited about this podcast now than I was a year ago. This is because I found a niche, I found a place where I can contribute. I haven't been to seminary. I can't do deep discussions about some fine detail of theology. I'm a simple guy who loves God, loves his neighbour, loves his family and friends, and loves stories. When JD and I bounced the idea around, it was in part a reaction to all the hate that the emerging church folks were getting. The idea was that you can argue to death about many things, theology for example, but you can't argue about person's experience. It's theirs and theirs alone. I am a firm believer in the power of stories. People don't want preach that. Our good news isn't some obtuse ology to be debated, but a life-affirming, life-transforming, ongoing experience. And it is these experiences that should be articulated. To this end, my first clip is Trucker Frank. who speaks candidly about stories.
Story after story out there on the road of things that have happened, and it has made me realize that one of the really sad things that is happening in the institutional church today is we have one man every Sunday telling everybody else, interpreting the Bible for them, but sitting in the pews are hundreds of thousands of stories that people never get to hear just because of the way we run church. And I'm convinced that the more we allow people to open up and to share their life, the more the body of Christ will grow, strengthen, and mature.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in most institutional settings, when a person reveals a weakness, it's like throwing blood in the water to a bunch of sharks. And I think the reason that is they attack that person because it gets the attention away from them. If we can put it all on that person, then maybe people won't find out about me and the way that I live. And it is so sad to see that happen.
Mm-hmm.
But that is what occurs. So as a result, I don't think Jonathan and hi, Thomas, if you're listening, by the way, I enjoy your input. I don't think I can ever go into an institutional church again in the capacity of a pastor or whatever. I guess for want of a better word, the small group that I meet with, we call ourselves free-range Christians, and we liken it to like wild horses out there.
I was thinking free-range chicken, so that's the first thing that came to my mind.
Free-range chicken, yeah. Well, chickens just doesn't paint a noble image, you know.
We need to empower people to tell their stories, to encourage them to advocate for their own experience in this way. It's not about one to many, but many to many. Each one reach one through the power of our individual stories. We need to move towards full participation when we gather together in his name and move away from consumption and the consumer mentality. The next clip is where Stuart picks this out in our tribes talk.
I think, you know, you can extend that analogy across to the church. You know, I guess what I see there is a real lack of user-generated content.
Yeah.
You know, there's this sense that, you know, all the content's generated from the front or from the organisation,
yep,
or whatever. And, you know, that people come along and consume,
mm-hmm,
with no real influence over what they consume.
Yes.
And how it's consumed. You know, so I guess the analogy does play out,
mm-hmm,
you know, across the church.
This podcast has been modelled towards a participation rather than consumption model. It's a collaborative effort with JD, Stuart and myself. I am so grateful for my co-hosts. JD's production skills are fab and his interviewing is so professional. I'm such an amateur compared to him. Stuart has been a rock too, bringing his ideas into the mix, hooking up with some fab people and taking his turn with production. I love grabbing coffee with Stuart. And I hope to do so with JD, because that's the thing with this podcast, it's collaboration, albeit it's collaboration over the internet. I've never met JD, but I consider him to be one of my dearest friends. To this end, I thank God for Skype, for Twitter, for Facebook, for Ning, etc., for what these tools have enabled us to do. Anyway, I digress as always. Two further conversations that really challenged me. First off was Mark Horvath, a true inspiration and homelessness advocate, whose approach got me off my backside and out with the Salvation Army in Glasgow. His comments about the half-eaten sandwich really, really challenged me.
So, you know, I'm a little different. There's you got me going on the, people will say, well, I don't give money to the homeless. I give them my, you know, leftover sandwich from Cheesecake Factory. And you know what? Your brother-in-law, your airplane pilot, your lawyer, your mailman, you know, your nurse, they're all drinking. You know, they're all doing drugs, and you don't count. But we use that as an excuse. And there's things on, you know, I mean, a half-eaten sandwich doesn't buy tampons. And if you're a homeless female, you still have feminine needs.
Mm.
You know, when I was homeless, I was I would have got dope sick, and if I'm dope sick, I'm going to be vulnerable in the park. I interviewed a girl that will be on Invisible People. I'm finishing up the story this morning. Her walker was stolen. She's out on Hollywood Boulevard with a catheter, and her walker was stolen because she was asleep at night, and that's when you're vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm not saying, please understand, I'm not saying always give homeless money. Just, you know, use some wisdom, you know. There's times where I don't give a thing. But I'd never give a half-eaten sandwich just because, you know, that's going to make me feel less guilty as I walk out of a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Make sense?
Yeah.
Lastly, we come to Adele Sackler, a dear friend who I have never actually spoke to until we hooked up on Skype for the podcast. She is another dear friend who I consider a pioneer and inspiration. We had a lovely conversation. It wasn't an interview, it was more like two old friends having a conversation. And it did seem at times that she was interviewing me as much as I was trying to interview her. Her comments in the Emerging Church crystallized my view in this movement, where she talked about a space to question.
Well, I like how Pete Rollins says, you know, you meet someone and you're noticing the color of their eyes. You're not really listening to them in the conversation. But when you don't pay attention to the color of their eyes and you're really listening, it means you're really listening. You're really listening to the words the other person's saying. You get beyond that. And that's so important. I think we only listen to a surface level a lot of times. And that's really what I've appreciated about the emerging conversation, emergent church, is it has a range of people, a range of beliefs, but it really has been a place that people can question, that they can think out loud, doubt, and that's been enriching to my relationship with God and my faith, and I've really learned and love and appreciate it. Although it's not perfect, nobody or no structure is perfect.
We need more space to question, and we need more folk like Adele, or Mark Berry, or Andrew Jones, or Trucker Frank, or Frank Viola, or Brant Russo, or Emma Boyd, or Joy Ranton, or Eric Bryant, or Eleanor Burne-Jones, or Steve Knight. You get the drift. I thank God for this wonderful opportunity, and I give him all the credit. I thank him for all the wonderful people that I've had an opportunity to meet, or to speak to, or to connect to in some way. I think of the daily interactions I have with folk like Trucker Frank or Eleanor Burne-Jones, and I'm just so grateful for the opportunities that this podcast has given me. So please, let me thank everyone who has in some way contributed to the podcast, and thank you for listening. You know, it is great. I'm grateful that you do listen, that you do download the podcast and put it on, and hopefully it will inspire you. It is appreciated. Thank you.
Upon the rails, among the weeds, I had a moment of serenity. I saw you stand.
If people want to get in touch with us, definitely we still would love to hear your thoughts on Annie's story. Maybe you have a similar story that you'd like to kind of share your experiences. Be sure to drop us an email, somethingbeautifulpodcast@gmail.com, or check us out on the webpage. You can leave comments and so forth there, somethingbeautifulpodcast.com. Also have the Facebook group, Facebook page. I think you and me are the only two members of as of right now. But, oh well, no big deal. also Twitter, SB Podcast on Twitter. And if you'd like to call our listener line, it's 972-535-8980. You can call and leave a message there. And or just record a message on MP3 like Thomas did for his little story that he gave, a little clip, and email that to us, somethingbeautifulpodcast@gmail.com. Any closing thoughts before we head out, Stuart?
I have
none whatsoever. All right.
No, to tell you what we're doing.
Yeah.
I said none. Yeah, that's terrible. We're, you know how we started the Emerging Scotland network? We're having a meetup tomorrow night. We're meeting in the patron saint of Emerging Church. We're meeting in St. Arbuck's in Glasgow tomorrow. So we're really looking forward to that. It should be really good to get together with some folks I've never met before. So, yeah, that, looking forward to
now
that.
Are you saying this is tomorrow night as in, because it's a podcast?
As well, it's on Thursday night, so it's going to be last night. So, yeah, it was great, and loads of people turned up, and we had a fascinating discussion, and drank
very
coffee.
Good. At the patron saint, St. Arbuck's.
As the patron saint, St. Arbuck's.
Now, actually, tomorrow night, when this comes out on Friday, our group here in Red Oak is hoping to do a Laundry of Love project, and so hoping to, that's going to kick off well. I'm still actually waiting to hear back from the owner of the laundromat. He told me yes, and then I went to confirm, and he was kind of like, I'll call you back. I don't know if you're familiar with the Laundry Love at all. I've kind of tweeted some about it, but it's a very cool it's a very cool project where basically we go in, or groups go in. I think there's 20 or so around the country, and basically just take a jar full of quarters and for an hour or two hang out at the laundromat and pay for people to do their laundry. And just kind of hang out, build relationships, and so forth. So really looking forward to kicking that off here in the Red Oak area. It's a very simple thing that hopefully we can do and give them some hope in whatever situation they're in. So looking forward to that. And just a
Look forward to hearing
just a plug. It's redoakllp.wordpress.com. We got a little website there if they want to find out some more. Or just four, the number 41.org is the national group. So there you have it.
Yep. Social action and action.
Very good. But be sure to check us out next week. We'll be back with the second part of Annie's story. Definitely a great story of how this kind of all reconciles and kind of the redemption portion of the story and the changes that God has done in her life. So look forward to that next week on the Something Beautiful podcast. Come around here, won't you come around here, yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Something Beautiful podcast. Join us again next week at somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.